Fritz.
Here.
Fish. Saltzman.
Here.
Novick.
Here.
Hales.
The item.
Accept report on the African American community in Multnomah County by the Coalition of Communities of Color.
Well, I'm very pleased to convene this important discussion this afternoon and for us as a council and as a community to get into depth on the good work that's been done and on the challenges that that work poses for us as a city. I just want to start by acknowledging that the state and city and federal policies have created real inequity that stretches back for generations and continues today. And this report highlights the particulars of that inequity. I think we have cause as a city to take pride in some of the programs and improvements that we have made and are making in our community, but also to acknowledge that it's not enough and that we need to do more. And again, this report and this presentation that we have up, lined up this afternoon will give us clarity and depth about those challenges and unmet promises. I think there's some things that we will be discussing as a council here soon in our budget process that will matter. We have an Office of Equity. In fact, Dante will be leading this afternoon's presentation. We have senior level equity positions in some of our bureaus and other positions like those being proposed to manage the improvement of how each of our bureaus serves the community and reflects the community. Next month, I'm going to be hosting a Governing for Racial Equity conference for elected officials from around the country here in Portland to discuss shared challenges and opportunities that face us all across the country. When we look at economic opportunity and vitality, we see some cause for progress or some cause for optimism in Portland. In 2013-14, PDC is going to be investing about $2.6 million in workforce development contracts with nonprofit organizations that help overcome barriers to employment. That includes groups like Oregon Tradeswomen, Constructing Hope, Human Solutions, Self-Enhancement, again, some organizations that are represented here. We've heard recently from Christine Moody and the progress that we're making in contracting in the city of Portland. Some particular standouts there, the $2.4 million renovation of Dawson Park has an 88% minority contracting performance, and that's something to be celebrated and replicated. Our Housing Bureau, of course, is here today. I think Tracy's here. Under your leadership, Commissioner Saltzman, and your predecessor, we're doing a lot to address affordable housing, but there's a lot more that we need to do. A couple of other recent initiatives, the Black Male Achievement Initiative that's being led by Antoinette Edwards in our office, is an opportunity for us to bring together groups, public, private, nonprofit, educational, and faith-based, to work together on real and sustainable and measurable improvements in the prospects of our young men and the metrics of equality. So those are just some glimpses into these issues from my vantage point as mayor. I know each of us on this council are committed to this work, and we're looking forward to hearing the presentation here today. We have a distinguished group of presenters. I think we're going to start with the first at least three or four. That is Dante James, Serena Boston Ashby, Tony Hobson, and Victor Merced. So come on up, please, and begin the presentation, and thank you so much for being here today. Pull up another chair there. We need one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, council members. It is truly my distinct honor to be able to just introduce this presentation to you this afternoon. I truly believe I certainly have a stake in this presentation for a number of reasons, both professional and personal. The presentation speaks to the African-American community here in Multnomah County. I think it stands on the heels of the groundbreaking work of the Urban League's State of Black Oregon report in 2009, as well as the four other presentations of the various aspects of this county that have been presented by the Coalition of Communities of Color. And so my office stands on the basis of all of this work, and clearly the communities have presented to you in the past the rationale and the reason for the existence of the Office of Equity and Human Rights in the City of Portland. So from a professional point of view, it clearly speaks to the importance of this work. From a personal point of view, I'm a black man. I live in this city, and I live this every day. And so reading through the various disparities that this report will present is of importance to me personally. And so I would ask that you, as you hear all of the numbers and statistics that will be presented to you today, prepared certainly by the great work of the authors, Dr. Bates and Dr. Curry Stevens, I would ask you, when you hear those numbers, to put a face to them, because they're not just numbers. They're your sister, your brother, your cousins, your children, your parents. And let that make a difference as it resonates to you, that they're not just numbers. We are people, and we exist in this county, and the disparities need to be reduced. And so there's a lot of information that we presented to you today. And again, I'm very honored and pleased to be able to introduce this presentation to you. And so without further ado, let me stop and introduce the Executive Director of the Portland African American Leadership Forum, Ms. Serena Boston Ashby.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dante. Good afternoon, Serena.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you, Dante. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you for having us here today. I serve as the director of the Portland African American Leadership Forum, and Paul has had the pleasure to convene several community organizations around the data that was collected through the opportunity from the Coalition of Communities of Color to write a report on the state of African Americans in Multnomah County. And what we have today are some section presentations to lay out before you to get a little bit into some of the data that's been discovered, but also to make it relevant to the city as well as you as decision makers. But of course, a report like this.
It fades in and out. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Of course, a report like this is no small feat, and so before we get into it, I did just want to have an opportunity to acknowledge those that have made this possible. And of course, that is the Coalition of Communities of Color, Portland State University, Multnomah County, of course, the City of Portland, as well as funding and support from United Way and the Northwest Health Foundation. I also wanted to explicitly thank our report authors, Dr. Lisa K. Bates, as well as Dr. Ann Curry Stevens, both of Portland State. And it is from Lisa's writing that this report was shaped, but also a lot of the data collection, or actually I should say all of the data collection from Dr. Ann Curry Stevens as well. So we acknowledge their hard work. Lastly, as I said, PAWF had the opportunity to really bring organizations together, and this is not a PAWF report. There are several organizations who not only contributed to the report and verified its data, but then those that actually signed off on a community support letter. And so I did just want to read those organizations and take the moment to do that. In addition to PAWF, we have the Urban League of Portland, and I know that CEO of the Urban League, Mike Alexander, is in the audience today, sitting here in support of us, as well as PCRI, SEI, the Black Parent Initiative. And then, as I said, we have a support letter that was signed off by those organizations, and additionally, the Urban League Young Professionals, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated, Portland Alumni Chapter, PFLAG Black Chapter, the Albina Ministerial Alliance, the Black United Fund of Oregon, the Black Parent Initiative as mentioned, Better People, the Oregon Health Authority's Office of Equity and Inclusion, the African American Outdoor Association, the Coalition of Black Men, the International Center for Traditional Childbearing, Big Brothers Big Sisters of Columbia Northwest, and then lastly but not least, the Governor's Commission on Black Affairs. So with that, I just want to acknowledge the effort that's gone into this report, and we look forward to the time that we have with you today. And then sitting beside me is the head of SEI, Tony Hobson Sr., who also is co-chair of PAWF, who is going to just give some statements as to why today is so important.
Thank you. Tony, good afternoon.
Thank you, Serena. Mayor and City Councilman, I appreciate again the opportunity to be here. Today, I think I could wear several hats, one as the chair of the Portland African American Leadership Forum, but two, president and CEO of Self Enhancement, Inc., a 35-year-old nonprofit agency that has specialized in servicing the African-American community, but also as a resident of our city for just turned 60, so been around a long time, seen a lot of things. Also want to say thank you to Portland State University Communities of Color Coalition and PALF and the many, many others that have put in quite a bit of work to bring us to this point today. Let me start with a quick quote. We are faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. This is no time for apathy or complacency. This is a time for vigorous and positive action. It's a quote by Martin Luther King. I guess I'd like to say, let's make sure that it's not too late. And the key words in this to me, when we talk about the fierce urgency and now, is the word now. Most folks focus on urgency, but really we're talking about now. The question is now for who? The people that need to eat right now, people that need housing now, people that need jobs now, people that need education now, need health care now, or people that just need hope right now. The challenge is always who controls now. I'd venture to say, and I think it's safe to say, that you all are in position maybe not to control the now, but certainly to impact the now. If we look at the word now from a different point of view, I might suggest these stats. Today, right now, happening in Black America, and each day in Black America, 3 children or teens are killed by guns. 95 children are arrested for violent crimes. 199 babies are born to teen mothers. Right now, happening today, 310 babies are born into extreme poverty. 384 children are confirmed as abused or neglected. Today, in Black America, 763 high school students will drop out. 1,274 children will be arrested. 6,191 public school students will be suspended. We as Black people realistically just want to control our now. We know what to do, and we know how to do it. We know what is necessary to positively impact the growth and prosperity of Black children and families. So today's report provides you with the data, on one hand, realistically should make you sick to your stomach. On the other hand, it should compel you to demand change by moving beyond a conversation of just equity to resource realities of equity. If true equity is important, then you must be deliberate, intentional, and consistent with your leadership and resources that support what works with Black children and Black families. As Martin Luther King said, tomorrow is today. And that means today, not tomorrow. You as elected officials have a tremendous opportunity to help us move forward. I trust that this report will provide you with the motivation, and if not the motivation, the justification to do what's right. What's right is your resources following the data and supporting the services that are necessary to decrease the disparities that Black children and families are faced with in this city. Again, I thank you for this opportunity. I think we have the kind of information that should put us on the right track, and hopefully you will find the courage necessary to put the resources where they need to be to help some of our most vulnerable children and families in our county. Thank you.
Thank you. Victor, good afternoon.
Afternoon. For the record, Mayor Hales, Victor Merced, Executive Director of Hacienda CDC, and Commissioners, thank you for inviting us here today. I'm here as a leader in the Latino community. I'm here also as a representative of Hacienda CDC and also as a member of the Coalition of Color. We're lending our support to our African-American brothers and sisters in their report to you today because their issues are our issues are their issues. And we hope that through this report that we learn collectively what we can do together to address some of the issues of disparity and equity in this state. As a member of the Coalition of Color, obviously you know what we do. We're an advocacy organization. We provide education and we promote our collective issues. Why we do it? Because there exist disparities in this society. There are equity issues that continue to be address, and we believe wholeheartedly that integrating our community while maintaining our identity is an admirable goal. We hope today that what we share with you, the insights that faces the African-American community in terms of the challenges and issues, we hope that you collectively think about the policies affecting people of color, and we hope that you continue to involve our community in those issues that are important to us, particularly in this case, the African-American community. So in closing, let me just quickly say that I had the occasion several years ago of having lunch in Africa with Dr. Richard Leakey, the foremost anthropologist in the world, and I'll never forget what he said when he closed that lunch. He said, "We all come from the same place, and we believe that." So thank you.
Thank you all. Questions for this panel? We may have more as we proceed because we've got quite a lineup. But don't, council members, feel free to, each time we have panelists here, to go ahead and pitch in. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I believe our Serena, do you want to keep calling people and stay there and be air traffic control?
I can, yeah. I think what I'll do is I'll sit here and just control the slides, and if you'd like to call people up, or I can as well.
Please go ahead. Because you.
So we have next to get into the presentation report author, Dr. Lisa K. Bates. Okay. And then we have a few sections right after that, and so I'll call forth Dr. Bates, Kali Thorne-Ladd, as well as Maxine Fitzpatrick. And I think that fills up the seats for now.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Again, just wanting to give a quick overview, and Serena's already acknowledged, and I think it's important to do so again, the really heavy data lift that's been done by Dr. Ann Curry-Stevens and her team at Portland State, and also the group of community experts, some of whom you'll hear from today, but others also in the community who really reviewed and verified and helped provide context around these data. We've assembled a range of indicators, and today's presentation will be focused not on the entirety of the report, which I believe that you have, but on the issues and areas where the city has the opportunity to address and rectify disparities for the African-American community. These data clearly show serious racial gaps in outcomes that must be closed through policy and program implementation. And it's important that we look at data, right? The data on racial equity are collected to evaluate results and to set new metrics for success that include racial justice outcomes, as have been lifted up in documents from the Portland Plan's equity strategy to the Office of Equity and Human Rights strategic plan and throughout many bureaus. At the same time, we also know that the data that we have are not always sufficient to track progress toward racial equity for all communities of color. So, for example, in this report, you will see a number of tables where the census designation Black is used, and that actually encompasses both African Americans, intergenerational African Americans, and more recent African immigrants who have distinct issues around culture, language acquisition, sort of different histories and experiences. So, in many cases, we've checked these data against community knowledge and understandings of how the world works for us, and to confirm and identify issues. And it's important that there would be more community-verified data to address these kinds of policy issues. It's also really critical for the institutions that we have, for city agencies and programs, to adjust their collection and reporting of data to reflect an ability to address a racial justice lens on policy and program implementation. But with all that being said, we have the data now. Data are available. They often show very stark disparities and can already provide a clear basis for action. So just to give a brief overview, the community profile of African Americans in Multnomah County is one of resilience. In a place with a history of discrimination and institutionalized racism that has really demonstrable impacts. African Americans are not a large community in Multnomah County, about 52,000, including all Blacks. But the community's presence in the face of local history is in itself remarkable because we weren't supposed to be here at all. From the Oregon exclusion laws, to the attempts to expel African Americans who came to Portland to support shipbuilding during World War II, many of whom departed after experiencing extreme segregation at Vanport, the flooding, the relocation to the Albina district, and facing deep hostility in housing and employment markets. Others have been dislocated by multiple urban renewal projects that cleared away homes and businesses. And more recently, urban renewal activities and increased market pressure have shifted the Black population away from historical neighborhoods and, in some cases, outside of the boundaries of the city of Portland. And you can see that on these maps here. And in the next slides, Northeast Portland, the historical heart of the African-American community, is revitalizing. It's receiving infrastructure and service upgrades. But in many cases, African-Americans are not actually experiencing those benefits. If we look big picture at the sort of current state of the Black community, there are, again, a number of distressing indicators here. Black unemployment is persistently high. It's been high for decades. And the employment recovers most slowly after a recession compared to other communities. Double-digit unemployment has been faced by the African-American community in Portland since the 70s. Black wealth building has been limited by very low homeownership rates, and Maxime will speak more about housing disparities. We know that our Black children and youth are often not thriving in local institutions with serious disparities in school achievement, exclusionary discipline disparities, and challenges by institutional policies in the criminal justice system. Black well-being is also threatened by health disparities, as well as problems with environmental justice, again, connected to the displacement from our higher-resourced areas. And the Black community has far too many negative encounters with police and the criminal justice system, as we know well here in the city of Portland. So as we move forward, different community experts will talk in more depth about these issues. And again, I'll help if there's any questions.
Hi, Mayor Hales, commissioners. For the record, my name is Kelly Thornladd, and thank you for having me here today. I'm going to go over the indicators and data around education and child welfare. And I'll start with just a brief overview of both. Racial disproportionality and disparity in the child welfare system are not new issues. It's been a growing concern in the state of Oregon to the point that in 2009, then-Governor Colin Gosky established a child welfare equity task force to focus on it. Oregon has taken the opportunity over the past 3 years to address the high numbers of children in foster care in the state system, with emphasis on targeting the disproportionate numbers of African-American children. And we are thankful to the city for the annual investment of roughly $1.2 million into the, you know, to support foster youth through the children's levy. In terms of educational attainment, the racial achievement gap is perpetuated by policies that fail to acknowledge limited access to early childhood programs, education, healthcare, housing, and economic opportunities. In 2009, 15% of Black adults in our region have not completed high school, and that's compared to only 6% of whites.
Excuse me.
Similarly, 42% have a post-secondary degree. This is white adults have a post-secondary degree, but Black adults are not nearly as likely, and only 14% have a post-secondary degree. So you see that at the end of the continuum of education, there are gross disparities, but you'll find as we go through the data that it starts quite young. So first, with child welfare and foster care rates, I'll let you look at this graph here. African Americans are much more likely to be reported to Child Protective Services. At each decision point in the Child Protective Service review, there are small disparities that result in a substantial difference in how many children end up in foster care. The cumulative impact is a foster care population that is over 21% Black children, even though the child population in the region is only 11%. We know that the outcomes for children in foster care, regardless of race, are some of the lowest on the scale of educational outcomes, social outcomes, and economic outcomes. So this overrepresentation that we see is a tragedy that we really need to pay attention to. Next chart depicts the likelihood that a Black child will experience this length of stay in foster care compared to the average rate.
Black children are more likely to stay in foster care for over 4 years. They're much less likely to return to their families. Again, huge impact on outcomes across all indicators. I'll go more now into the education side of things. You can see that there's an education achievement gap, and I think it's worth noting that this gap has been prolific for over 50 years. You can see that the gap starts early as third grade, and recent kindergarten readiness assessment results that came out show that it actually starts before third grade. When children enter school in kindergarten, there is a gap. So they're spending all of their time virtually in the K-12 system playing catch-up. It's exacerbated by things like expulsion and suspensions policies, as well as summer learning loss. These gaps continue to widen as they progress through school, as I said. So what you see is a gap that is disconcerting at third grade, but it grows significantly by 10th grade. And so the impact of that is we don't have students that are graduating and having access to post-secondary or living wage jobs. There actually was a recent report that came out in The Atlantic that talked about particularly, it was a report by the Bureau of Economic Research and James Heckman and Lakshmi Rout, and they concluded that if we could do more even in the early years, preschool, that we would do something to reverse the trends of poverty for children, all children, particularly children of color, and that the cost benefits to our society would be great. So there's a lot to say for educating our children better. Next slide is on high school graduation rates. There are two ways of measuring graduation rates, and in the past they've taken a snapshot to look at what graduation rates are, but they don't really tell you how many kids are actually going from 9th grade through 12th grade. So what you see here is a cohort graduation rate, which gives a much more accurate sense of how kids are traveling through. It also gives us a chance to compare across districts. So you can see here all of the districts within Multnomah County, and of course Portland, Park Rose, David Douglas, Centennial, and Reynolds all serve Portland City students. And this rate accounts for students who drop out or who do not earn a diploma. So they're not the same thing, but you get a sense of the picture.
Could you just go back to the previous slide? Because I remember when we had the report on the Native American communities that Centennial was doing better than a lot better, and it looks like for African American kids that it's a smaller gap for sure, but mm-hmm. They haven't had as much success even in a program that otherwise had been doing fairly well. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think what you're seeing, particularly in some of the East Portland schools, is that black communities have not always been in black children have not always been in these schools, and I've heard from district superintendents the desire to serve them better, but the recognition that it's a newer demographic and they're having to partner with organizations like SEI to support the students so that they can be successful in school.
Thank you.
And that, I think, underscores the importance of community-based organizations and helping students succeed. So this next slide is probably one of the most disconcerting to me. The most extreme discipline disparities are for African-American students by far. Exclusionary discipline is 3.5 times more likely for black students than whites. Many incidents resulting in suspension or expulsion, many of the incidences resulting in suspension and expulsion are chosen because of subjective reasons. So in other words, administrators, teachers, for offenses that are subjective, like they were disrespectful, black students are more likely to get kicked out of class or get kicked out of school for them. And most of the reasons why these students are kicked out of school are nonviolent. No weapons are involved. These disparities, what's I think the most challenging thing is that these disparities pop up as early as kindergarten. So children as young as 7 years old are being kicked out of class 3 times more likely than any of the other students in the class. And so you're starting a narrative for young children telling them that they don't belong in school or that their behavior is not appropriate, that they're not accepted there. You can see what the consequences are through the other data that we've already looked at. And reversing these trends is of paramount importance. So I'll move now into some policy recommendations. The first, expanding investment in the culturally diverse pool of, oh wait, sorry. Okay, I'm just going to read off this. Children's levy. So considering expansion of investments in the culturally diverse pool of foster and adoptive resources, and we are thankful for the children's levy and the level of investment that they have made for children in the welfare system. Enhancing equity through the adoption of specific practices such as community partnerships, family group decision making, structured decision making, things that we know make a difference and move the needle for black students or black children. When you reauthorize the children's levy, which I know is happening now, we ask that you pay special attention to investments that serve the African-American community and partner with organizations that serve the black community. We encourage you to continue your investments in early childhood, also through the children's levy, with specific focus on programs that serve black children. We support continued investments in programs like Future Connect, which has retention rates that are 3 to 4 times higher than other students with the exact same demographics in community college. Those programs give black students the option to graduate from high school, access on-ramps to not just a post-secondary education, but a job. That makes a difference. And I know all of you have heard the testimony of students participating in those programs. And as a PCC board member, I'm very thankful for the city's continued support of that program. Continued investment in jobs programs for youth. The city has been bold enough to support summer jobs and recognizing that summer learning loss is as much as one grade level. And so having students be involved during the summertime in things that are helpful to their career and their future is of paramount importance as well. And so we ask that you continue those investments and, where possible, expanding those investments. And then finally, investment in updates to the report. This report enables us to see what's really happening. It's not just conjecture. It's not just conversation. It's the real deal. And we hope to continue updates to the report. Your investment and support in that is critical. So with that, I'll close the presentation. If there are any questions around education and child welfare, I welcome them.
I have one. Are you familiar with the restorative justice program?
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about whether that's effective?
So restorative justice is, I think, most prolific at Park Rose School District, and the superintendent has adopted it whole scale. I think the key to the success of that program is how it's adopted. And so there are other programs that deal with discipline that, if not adopted fully, which is not often the case, unfortunately, you're not able to have the impact that you want to have. So I think restorative justice has done well at Park Rose, and I think it's because the entire district, the superintendent, really got all of the building leaders and teachers bought into this program. And so they are doing a lot of work, and you'll see, and I think Superintendent Gray would say there's still work to be done, and they are working on equity policy and other things to continue to move the needle more than they have, but they are seeing an impact, less because, I would say, of restorative justice and more because of the mindset of the leaders in that district. Is that helpful?
Yeah. So are we seeing better outcomes for African-American students in the Park Rose District?
We are, but I think there's still room. And I think recently she was saying that we see outcomes at one grade level, but we're still not seeing the outcomes at all grade levels. So seeing the outcomes that we need to see across all grade levels, there's definitely a lot of room for growth. But I certainly applaud the superintendent and the district for adopting policy and a program to work at it.
I have a question. You talked about Future Connect and the Children's Levy and our jobs programs. Mm-hmm. Would you care to comment on Sun Schools and the extent to which Sun Schools are a strategy that you think is working or not, and what our role should be there?
Continued investment in Sun Schools is important, and it's funny, at the county presentation we talked a lot about the Sun School program and the importance of that in supporting students. I mean, the Sun Schools allow for students who have nowhere to go after school, who come from working families, to have a place where they can get education and support and tutoring, family support. So there's no question that the investment in the Sun program and the Sun service system is critical to supporting.
And I think interesting you say that you gave the report of the county, mm-hmm. because we have a shared system, and there has been some talk. Chair Kogan at one point had sort of mused, what if we consolidated the system? Mm-hmm. Should it be administered exclusively by the county, for example? But currently the city and the county
partner,
and it's a shared service. So anyway, thank you.
Yeah, and you know, of course, support the Parks and Recs and all the programs that Parks and Rec offers also helps students in the exact same way.
I think Portland Parks and Rec, Mayor, is the largest employer of youth in our community every summer.
Yes.
If you add up all the jobs in
they're
the schools,
key to the summer
all
jobs.
The jobs and all the positions. So it's a huge opportunity if we are thinking intentionally about recruitment.
Well, and in terms of what we might do in you know, the next stages of the city's response to your research, I think I want to key off this and pose the question, but if we were going to pick a next increment of investment, it seems to me that getting the Sun School program to more kids of color and more low-income kids, and we know where they are in the school system and which schools we're not yet serving, it seems to me that might be our next best step to take, but interested in your reactions to that.
I would agree, and one of the things that we recommended also was to really adopt an equity index to determine how to allocate resources.
Right.
They've focused on the poverty index, which is important. The equity index includes other factors as well as race and ways how you make investments based on that. So I would definitely encourage. I would also encourage continued support and partnership with All Hands Raised and the work they're doing on Round Ready for Kindergarten and the community school piece that they're doing, school supporting youth.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you sit on the Cradle to Career Council. So all of those investments are definitely critical in making an impact. And without them, we will see a reversal in any progress we make.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions, and then Maxine, you're up next.
Okay, well, thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Maxine Fitzpatrick, and I'm the Executive Director of Portland Community Reinvestment Initiatives. We're a community-based organization that develops and provides affordable housing in primarily in Northeast Portland, and I also co-chair the Portland African American Leadership Forum. Today, I'm going to do a brief overview of the economic development aspects of the city of Portland, as well as some housing information. I'll be as brief as I possibly can. First one that we're going to share with you, that you have the information there, is on the persistent employment challenges faced by blacks in Portland. I'm taking a look at this census that examines the period of 1970 to 2006. And as you will see, black male by far is the highest group challenged with employment. It ranges over that period from a low of 12% to 18%, which is about where it's at right now. Then we take a look at the African-American female, and that range is about 12% and go down as low as about 10%, and that's kind of where it's at right now, the unemployment rate for black females. And then we take a look at the white male. It's never been below 7.5%, and now it's averaging out at about 6%. And the white female averages out consistently under 6%. So there's the beginning of the challenges that are faced in the black community. That's supported by the poverty weight. I'm not going to go through all of the groupings here, but I will point out two or three that I think are very important. The first one being if we take a look at the poverty rates of all people, it'll show that in the white community it's 12.8%. Where in the black community, it's 34%, almost three times as high. The next one I think is important is black children under 18. It shows that black children under 18 live in poverty at a rate of 40.7% compared to 14.4% for white children under 18. The last one that I'll point out to you here is households with children under 18. It shows that in those households, in the black community, it's 45.1% of the households live in poverty compared to 11.9% in the white community. A couple economic points I'd like to share with you that also contributes to the imbalance that we see here. In 2010, the City of Portland and the Portland Development Commission commissioned a study on the utilization of minority-owned business enterprises and women-owned business enterprises. While contracts made as a part of the city's sheltered market and good faith programs meet the city's equity goals, and again, these goals are very low, outside of these specific programs, there is a failure to utilize MBE and WBE firms at the expected level, given their availability. For instance, outside the Good Faith Effort Program, only one of the city's 76 prime construction contracts over $100,000 was awarded to an MBE firm. For PDC-funded projects, fewer than 1% of all MBEs and WBEs are available receive contracts, despite a business equity program for subcontractors. These disparities were also present for professional service contracts. Lastly, the auditor found that half of the sheltered market contracts were awarded to white male-owned firms as small businesses, rather than closing the acknowledged disparity for African-American-owned firms. Next, I'm going to go into the housing report. Despite of over 50 years of fair housing law, African Americans continue to face serious disparities as described here in terms of housing affordability, home ownership and access to mortgages, homelessness, and discrimination. In Portland, as in other cities, strong and cohesive black neighborhoods were formed out of segregation, but were partially dismantled by highway and redevelopment construction and redline, or systematically denied credit and investment, leading to decline. As policymakers targeted these neighborhoods in the Albina district, market pressures quickly escalated, causing another displacement for African Americans from well-situated neighborhoods with new amenities to more distant, less accessible, and amenity-rich neighborhoods in Mid-County. When we take just a look at housing affordability and examine households that are spending greater than 30% of their income on housing, we take a look at renter households, and it shows that in the white community, there's 50.7% that renter households pay more than 30% of their income on housing, compared to 69% in the black community. And if we go and take a look at homeownership, it shows that about 39% of white households pay greater than 30% of their income on housing, compared to, in the black community, for homeownership, 54.4% pay more than 30%. Overall, in terms of housing and homeownership, just 32% of black households in Multnomah County are homeowners. Black-white homeownership gap for African Americans is 27 percentage points. It's almost double. And then I want to share with you some information from the period of 2009 to 2011 in terms of how the Portland Housing Bureau allocated funds by sponsor. As you can see, we have the largest allocation going up in excess of $47 million. And then if you take there's a gradual presentation of who got what. But what I really want to go into here is what was allocated to culturally specific organizations, namely Hacienda CDC, Sabin CDC, NAYA, and PCRI. And as you can see, out of that $146,789,000 allocated, only $4.4 million of that went to culturally specific organizations. While in our communities, we have the greatest housing disparities and housing issues, but organizations that focus specifically on addressing those issues were not funded. And I really think the city needs to take a serious look at its allocation process. So have some economic prosperity policy recommendations to share with you. In the Portland plan, you outline using agreements such as First Source Hiring to promote hiring of qualified local residents who have completed skills training or become unemployed. We recommend that you do this and report on your outcomes, particularly as it pertains to residents in minority communities. Next, we recommend that you continue work with the city's procurement services to increase contracting opportunities, including targeted prime contracting and community workforce agreements for minority contractors. We ask that for an expansion of summer internships to Future Connect students at PCC and Mount Hood Community College as a pipeline to long-term living wage jobs at the city. That you continue to work on the Neighborhood Prosperity Initiative and the Neighborhood Economic Development Strategy and report outcomes and impact of the African American community. Currently, there is a pilot community benefits agreement. Look at expansion of this project to help minority women and emerging small businesses. Next, I'm going to share with you our housing policy recommendations. But before I do that, I just want to take this couple snippets out of the Portland Housing Bureau 2011 to 2013 strategic plans. It's outdated by a month or so, but I think until it's revised and updated, we'll live with what we have here. In the equity statements contained in the Portland Housing Bureau vision and values, it says all Portlanders have equitable access. One of the goals that all Portlanders have equitable access to housing and to opportunities for safe, stable housing, that safe, stable housing can deliver, free from discrimination. It says we are committed to social justice in the delivery of housing to all residents of Portland's diverse communities. We embrace diversity in our workforce and culture, but when we look at the allocation of resources, it does not support that. PHB investment priorities provide more rental housing for the most vulnerable people. Next, it says move people quickly from homelessness to permanent housing while preventing families from losing their homes. We saw 10,000 people lose their housing over a period of 10 years in North Northeast Portland. And it said next, it says that you would help Portland from communities, help Portland. There's from communities of color, buy a home or keep the home they already own. We still have the same disparity in home ownership in Portland that existed historically. There has not been any significant change, even though at the same time the city of Portland adopted a 10-year plan to end homelessness, it adopted a 10-year plan to mitigate the minority home ownership. There has not been any change or significant investment to support that change. Next, it says provide a safety net that includes shelters and other short-term help for low-income Portlanders who are homeless or at risk of homelessness. We watched, I witnessed professionally and personally the homelessness that occurred in Northeast Portland when all of a sudden families were forced to relocate. Involuntary displacement, something that in the Interstate Urban Renewal Area, the Portland Development Commission, now acting through the Portland Housing Bureau, made significant commitments that that would not happen. The housing policy recommendations that we have here, it is in a form to mitigate. And we always talk about equity, and one of the things that housing organizations of color recognize and know that you do too, is that being equitable does not mean always mean being equal in how you do what you do. So we're going to ask for mitigation policies here. So we're going to ask that you mitigate the displacement of African Americans in accordance with the Interstate Urban Renewal Area Housing Strategy aimed at minimizing displacement per a commitment made by the City of Portland in 2002 and never honored. Took a look, and for the period of 2014 to 2016, there's about $96 million in resources that was noted in the five-year plan that I reviewed. So of that $96 million that's going to be allocated over that period, we're asking that 50% of that Approximately $48 million of those housing funds go to communities of color. With a significant portion of that, I would recommend 75% or $36 million of that going to address involuntary displacement of black people in North and Northeast Portland during the period of 2000 and 2010. And when I look at housing development, I work in this industry, and I know that $36 million to a layperson may seem like a lot of money, but I see it invested in projects consistently in the city. So it is not an alarming amount to me, but I'm being considerate. We are being considerate of what's available. We also request that you provide a record of housing allocations by a sponsor for the period of 2012 to 2013. What I shared with you earlier was what happened from 2009 to 2011. And as you can see, 1% of that entire allocation went to support our communities. We asked that PHB release reports that they provide to HUD detailing how it is meeting the necessary allotment of CDBG, home, and federal grants in accordance with HUD funding requirements. We ask for historical allocation, the historical allocation of tax incremental funds for the 30% affordable housing set aside for the Interstate Urban Renewal Area. A few more, if you bear with me here. We ask that you dedicate watchdog staff to legislate a Section 8 voucher non-discrimination for African-American clients specifically. PCRI is the single largest provider of housing for Section 8 voucher recipients, which is very different from project-based. Next, we ask that you support the repeal of no-cause eviction laws, which undermine tenants' ability to advocate for healthier homes, that you work to increase penalties for landlords that refuse to comply with Healthy Homes Program, and find best ways to support staff to underline offenses as they occur. And with that, I'll stop.
Questions?
Well, I have so many questions. We could have a hearing. We could extend this through the evening, but I'm going to take advantage of this moment to ask you four. And the first, Maxine, has to do with the question you posed earlier about the 30% set aside in Interstate. So I'd like your views and guidance to us as to whether you think 30% is a floor or a ceiling.
I know that 30% is a floor.
For the benefit of, we have new members of the council.
Okay.
This was adopted before. They were, I was curious why you think that.
Why do I think that? That the 30% set aside is the floor?
I agree with you. So
I'm giving you a chance to make the case for both of us. It's written, it's documented that it is the floor and not the ceiling.
So there are some in the community who treat it as if it's a ceiling. I agree with you. I think it's a floor. So the second question I wanted to ask you is, who should we be serving? Now, we've identified people who we've identified disparities, so we have a racial lens. But there are some in our community who argue that we should lift the income restrictions and serve to upwards of 100% of MFI. And my question to you is, within Interstate, where's the need and where should we focus the resources?
I go back to Interstate. I have to go back to 2000. And where was the need in 2000 when the urban renewal area was formed? And it was somewhere in the range of 40 to 60, as low as 30. So that was a commitment that was made that the city would house, would make sure that those people that lived in Northeast Portland at that time, that lived in 30 and 40 and 50% housing, would have an opportunity to remain and stay in housing that they could afford.
You mentioned a watchdog for the historic legislation last year that prohibits discrimination against Section 8 voucher holders, which disproportionately impacts people of color, older adults, people with disabilities. Is your vision that the housing authority hire someone to play that role, or that the different jurisdictions pool their resources, or how would that work?
Well, we can work with those jurisdictions to make that decision. Right now, I don't think that we basically decided on exactly how it should be structured, but we know that it's needed.
Good, thank you.
Other questions?
Fitzpatrick, first of all, thank you for agreeing to be on the Bureau of Development Services.
Thank you.
Development Review Advisory Committee. That was on the Council's consent calendar this morning, but I'm very honored that you're willing to help on that committee. And then I wanted to comment about the community benefits agreements and let you know that we're going to be building two new parks in East Portland at Beach and Gateway, and that I've directed the Parks Bureau to make both of those community benefit agreements
Thank you.
Ms. Fitzpatrick, hi. I think you called for spending $36 million to address historic displacement of the African American community in North and Northeast Portland.
Right.
What are you envisioning? What specific expenditures are you envisioning? What will we buy with the $36
million? I could probably do some calculations, but I would say if I look at what you've bought with $36 million in the past, probably 300 units.
Okay.
Low, moderate?
Yeah, most definitely it would be for households under 60% of their median income.
Yeah.
Okay. But done through the community organizations that you mentioned.
Yes.
Okay. Good. Other questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Mayor, do we have an additional panel?
We do.
Okay,
we do. I understand that we're running out of time, so I'm just going to ask folks to come forward. Also give them an opportunity to present on their sections. So rounding out the presentation today, we have Ty Schwafferman, who's the Health Equity Coordinator at the Urban League of Portland, who will talk about our health section, and then also Manuel Price, who's Director of Escafe, and then lastly, Gerald Deloney, who's in leadership with the Coalition of Communities of Color.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
All right. Good afternoon, Mayor Charlie Hales and members of our commissioners. I just wanted to start by saying thanks to Dr. Bates and Ann Curry Stevenson for developing and writing this project and the research that's gone into this. And of course, the Coalition of Communities of Color for compiling the unsettling reports, which have looked at health disparities across all communities, including the African-American community. So today I'm going to talk about existing health threats to our community, particularly African-Americans. Health outcomes disparities for African-Americans in the Portland, Multnomah County are severe for some indicators. African-Americans have the highest rate of homicide, mortality among all racial groups, a rate that's more than six times higher for African Americans than whites. In Portland and Multnomah County, African Americans are more than twice as likely as whites to die of diabetes. This fits as a national trend showing that African Americans are diagnosed with diabetes at double the rate of whites. Diabetes is associated with increased risks to a number of serious and sometimes life-threatening complications, including blindness, including removal of limbs. And African Americans are experiencing more than three times more likely to suffer of removal of lower limbs, amputations. So, STDs, particularly gonorrhea, remains a preventable disease that is highly prevalent within the African American communities. Now on to policy recommendations. Understand that these are, as complete as they are right now. However, I'd like to add a few more that aren't listed on the PowerPoint. As the city is a purchaser of health insurance, and as a purchaser of health insurance, one thing that we are advocating for within the African American community is the use of more community health workers and doulas, and specifically culturally specific African American community health workers and doulas, and traditional health workers. Insurance providers play a major role in this, in that they can actually offer these within their plans, and especially for folks who are on Medicaid, they should be able to access community health workers to work directly with a community health worker, as well as their other medical providers. So if we were to kind of walk away with anything, is really, seeing more people that look like us in the workplace, in health occupations, We've seen, looking at the data, that health occupations at all levels are not represented by, fully represented by African-American providers. We see that, you know, levels of like CNAs and at the very low level, occupational levels, we're seeing African-Americans there and represented. But in the higher occupational trade and in the trades, we would like to see more African-Americans kind of building into that pipeline. And one of those